Welcome to the Listen Lounge, where the sounds of smooth jazz meet the chilling screams of murder. Death in the Headlights, a Kyle Callahan mystery. It's been 6 months since the Pride Gallery murders in Manhattan. Kyle Callahan and his partner Danny Durbin head to rural New Jersey for a relaxing weekend with their dear friend, Detective Linda Sikorsky, recently retired and newly in love. Driving back from dinner with Linda and her fiancé Kirsten, they discover the body of Abigail Creek, run off the road on a bicycle, wearing only her nightgown and slippers. Kyle and Linda quickly find themselves learning more than they want to know about the Creek family and the home they call Cross Creek Farm. In the words of Clara Presley's grandmother, "Whatever grows there grows in the shadows." Come along as Linda and Kyle make their way into the shadows and enter the spider's web, determined to find out who in this family of spiders is the deadliest one.
Death in the Headlights, a Kyle Callahan mystery, featuring Detective Linda. Written by Mark McNeese. Narrated by Daniela Accitelli. Chapter 1. Abigail Creek sat on her bed about to watch a horror movie. Halloween was 2 weeks away, but already the stations were playing reruns of The Exorcist and Friday the 13th, versions 1 through 12. She'd only seen the first one. She didn't care much for sequels, and was delighted that John Carpenter's original Halloween 1978 with young scream queen Jamie Lee Curtis was showing tonight. It was almost enough to make her glad she was too sick to go to dinner with the family. Correction, the family and Charlotte. The five of them were behaving as a unit more often since the divorce negotiations had reached their final phase. Abigail hated the act she'd put on throughout the process, pretending it was all fine with her. 62 years old and being usurped by a woman 20 years younger who was once her dearest friend. A woman she had introduced to her husband Clarence. A woman who had all but moved into Cross Creek Farm, befriending the family, preparing to become the new matriarch, as Abigail graciously and quietly stepped aside. "Oh, have I got a surprise for you," she thought, settling in against the headboard with a bowl of freshly popped corn and a tall glass of Alka-Seltzer. She had no idea if it was the right thing to take for the stomach cramps that struck her late in the day, an unforeseen and sudden illness she attributed to the stress she was under. She was feeling noticeably better now, and thought she might be on the mend enough to enjoy the movie without doubling over in pain. Whatever it was passing. Too late for dinner with the others, but maybe that was why she had taken ill in the first place, a psychosomatic solution to a problem not easily solved. John Carpenter's simple, eerie score began as the movie started. Abigail couldn't believe it had been 36 years since she first saw the movie on its release, watching through her fingers at the scariest parts. Her heart felt a stab at the memory. She had been with Clarence then, in her mid-20s and madly in love. She had gripped his hand throughout the movie and had believed then, and up until just this past year, that she would be holding his hand until the day she died. "Let it go, Abby," she told herself. "He has betrayed you. Let it go. Set the trap, pull the spring, be patient." She had just taken her first handful of popcorn from the bowl when she heard it. A creaking sound. A footstep. A footstep? "That's silly," she told herself, even as she felt the hair rise on her arms. "It's just a creak. Why do you think they call it Cross Creek Farm?" she asked herself, smiling. "Cross Creek? Of course it creaks. It's old and large and empty. Empty except for Abigail and the alarm. Clarence always turned it on when he left. He kept it on when they were at home, too. Unlike many homeowners who don't realize the most valuable thing they can protect is themselves. The only sound there should be reason to jump at was the alarm going off. She took another handful of popcorn and tried to focus on the movie. Jamie Lee was so young then. And now she made yogurt commercials, looking mature but still radiant. Abigail wondered if it was the yogurt that preserved her so well. The sound of a creak came again. It wasn't the sound of the house settling or floorboards adjusting to the cooler temperatures. It was the sound of someone in the house. Had one of them come home for some reason? Maybe her stomach problem was catching. But that made no sense. They'd driven in one car. Had they all returned? Clarence? She called out. Caroline? Are you back already? There was no reply, and the creaking stopped. She reached for the remote and muted the television. She listened carefully in the silence. She knew better than to call out again. It was too late not to let an intruder know she'd heard him. Or had she simply heard the house moaning and settling? Then the creak came again, and she knew she was not alone. She slipped out of bed, looking quickly around for her cell phone. Where had she left it? In the kitchen? The living room? She heard the creak again, closer, coming toward her. She turned the volume back on to mask her movements, then slipped out of bed and hurried into the bathroom. It had two doors, one leading into the master bedroom where she was, another on the opposite side leading into the back hallway. It would put her behind the intruder, and she was now sure there was someone in the house. She could feel a presence. Danger was not something one simply imagines. It has a heaviness to it, and a smell. Abigail smelled danger. The closer it came, the more pungent the threat. She quietly closed the bathroom door behind her, then dashed out into the back hallway. Her mind was racing. There was no time for a phone call, no time for the gun case. And what would she do with a gun she'd never bothered learning to fire? That was Clarence's job. Clarence's gun. No, she needed out of the house, out into the darkness. She heard him coming then, running after her. Him, her, she didn't know, and had no intention of finding out. No time for car keys, no time for weapons, no time. She ran through the kitchen and saw it, an open window above the sink. Had it been left open or unlocked? And wasn't it connected to the alarm that wasn't on? What difference could it make now? She had only her nightgown on and her slippers. It was cold outside, but not yet frigid. She dashed for the front door. Throwing it open, she breathed a gust of chill October air and thanked God for not abandoning her completely. Caroline and Rusty had gone for a bike ride that afternoon and left their bicycles in the driveway. Caroline's wasn't much of a bike, not one of the speedsters all the cyclists rode around this area. She had always wanted one like the bike she had as a child, and that's what Abigail grabbed now. Big, unwieldy, with handlebars that looked like antlers. A basket that never had anything in it, and pink. Abigail threw herself on the contraption, grateful she still knew how to ride, and pedaled furiously into the night. No lights on the road here. Maybe that would help her. But then again, no people either. No sound. No one to hear her calling for help. Chapter 2. Thomas West, 3rd Baron de la Warr, died 1618, the namesake of Delaware and the Delaware River, the only remaining undammed river in the eastern United States. The river flows unimpeded for 330 miles, from New York through Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware as it makes its way to the Atlantic Ocean. Not often thought of as mighty like its cousin, the Mississippi, It regularly overflows its banks in heavy rains and leaves its high water marks on many a home built close to the water. Linda Sikorsky had never been very curious about the river she now lived just a half mile from. She'd crossed it many times, back and forth from Pennsylvania to New Jersey, but it was simply a particularly lovely river to her. Then, in a stroke of serendipity tinged with grief, her Aunt Celeste died while watering the carnations on her back porch in the little house she had owned in Kingwood Township, New Jersey, for some 40 years. She left the house and its 5 acres to Linda, not to her son Jeffrey, as the family assumed she would. Jeffrey was, by all accounts, no account, and had moved to North Carolina with his third or fourth wife, no one was sure of the number, remaining in touch with his mother through the occasional Mother's Day card, when he remembered, and a visit every 3 to 5 years. That Celeste did not leave her house to him surprised no one. That she left it to Linda surprised only Linda. There really was no one else. Celeste's brother, Linda's father Pete, had been dead for 35 years. Celeste's own husband passed on a decade ago. Linda had been the one to visit her nearly every weekend, sometimes more often as age began to take its toll. But Celeste was determined to die on her property, if not in her bed, and it came as a relief to those who knew her when she did. That was 3 months ago, and after making all the arrangements that needed to be made, signing all the paperwork, and dealing with a furious Jeffrey, who missed the funeral but showed up in time to be denied the keys to the house, Linda vacated her apartment in New Hope, Pennsylvania, and moved in. Alone, on 5 acres of woods, up a road with more deer on it than cars, just a short walk and a shorter drive from the river, and it all happened so fast. Her fiancé, Kirsten, had not moved with her. They weren't ready to cohabitate. And now she was about to have her first visitors. Here for a week of country life, just 70 miles and a world away from the madhouse of Manhattan. Autumn in the Delaware River Valley is spectacular. Its blanket of trees lining the highways and back roads turn from emerald green to a mad rush of color, with auburns and reds and yellows bursting to life as the leaves turn toward a coming winter. Linda had never imagined herself living in the woods. She had known for years that most people's ideas of New Jersey were based on late-night comedians' jokes and uninformed ridicule that assumed New Jersey's ailing cities were the sum of it. But it was called the Garden State for good reason. Go just a short drive from Newark Airport and not far from New York City itself, and you'll find gorgeous riverbanks, forests, farms, and small town life. Linda had been accustomed to living in the valley, having served on the New Hope police force for 20 years. But she had never expected to find herself settling into a house not much bigger than a cottage on the Jersey side. She'd not had time to make it her own, and her aunt's presence was still everywhere. The furniture that had not changed since Linda was a child, the knick-knacks gathered through the years, the pots and pans, the flower beds on the back porch Celeste had been watering when death came to visit. Linda was torn about what to keep and what to change. But it would all come in time. And she wondered if Kirsten McClellan, the woman she expected to spend her life with, and who was now gazing out the passenger window into the dark woods along the road, would ever want to live here with her. The engagement had happened quickly, perhaps too quickly, considering the women had only been together 10 months. But Linda wanted to believe in the sincerity of Kirsten's proposal in August. The alternative, that both of them had been intoxicated with the flush of new love, and now sobriety was settling in, a sobriety that might have other plans, was not something Linda wanted to think about at the moment. So she focused instead on the conversation her friends Kyle Callahan and Danny Durbin were having in the back seat. The couple, Kyle and Danny, had come from New York City to spend 5 days with her. They both insisted on calling her Detective Linda, even though she'd retired 6 weeks ago. She would always be Detective Linda to them. They'd met a year earlier during the murders at Pride Lodge, when Linda was the homicide detective investigating the death of handyman Teddy. Then, 6 months later, Linda had gone to Manhattan for Kyle's first photography exhibit at the Catherine Pride Gallery, and once again found herself in pursuit of a killer. That one is especially nasty. Over the past year, they had become the closest of friends, and she knew they had come to spend time with her for more than a getaway. She was in transition, leaving the police force, opening a vintage goods store in New Hope soon, and, not the least of it, moving into a small house in the woods. They wanted to support her. This much change, this quickly, constrained the strongest spirit, and Linda's was weary. The four of them were driving home from dinner in Stockton. They'd had one of the best meals Kyle could remember ever having, enjoyed fireside in the old Miller Inn. He and Danny had driven by the place a few times on their trips to New Hope, as they explored the surrounding area, but they had never eaten there. The meal had been exquisite, as had the company. Kyle and Danny had taken quickly to Kirsten once she'd shown up at Kyle's photography exhibit. Her devotion to Linda was obvious, and the four of them had been talking about spending some real time together ever since. Tonight they were driving along Route 651, up toward Linda's house on Lockatong Road. Kyle and Danny had arrived that afternoon after a leisurely Friday drive from New York City that included lunch and some shopping at the Flemington Outlets. The day had been perfect, followed by a night of food, friendship, and memories. The only thing left was to visit a short while longer at the house and settle into the attic guest room for a cozy sleep beneath a thick down comforter. Linda was driving, chatting with Kirsten about the store she was planning to open. For Pete's sake, named after her late cop father, a vintage everything store she'd dreamed about ever since shopping at one she loved in Doylestown, Pennsylvania several years ago. She'd been back a half dozen times and made friends with Suzanne, the owner. Now, she was getting advice from Suzanne on how to open her own store and not go out of business in 6 months. She had the location picked out in New Hope and had signed the lease agreement that Wednesday. So much change. Kyle was about to ask the women what they wanted for the breakfast he'd promised to make, when the car suddenly slammed to a halt, jerking Kyle and Danny forward. Both were wearing seatbelts, and Kyle felt the belt dig into his shoulder. "What happened?" Kyle said, worried they'd hit a deer. The animals were everywhere out here, and they often bounded out in front of cars. A collision could be fatal, and not just for the deer. But there'd been no collision, no thud, no impact. "There," Linda said, pointing out the driver's window to the side of the road. The car was stopped, and they all followed her line of sight to the left shoulder. Just beyond it, in a pile of leaves that had accumulated in the day's wind, was a woman next to a bicycle. Linda quickly unfastened her seatbelt and jumped from the car, followed instantly by the others. A moment later, all four of them were standing around a body, for it was a body at this point, clearly deceased, wondering what had happened. The woman was dressed in a nightgown and slippers, as if she'd fled on her bicycle at a moment's notice. The bike was what Kyle called a Wicked Witch of the West bike, large, with giant handlebars and a basket between them big enough to carry a small dog. The bicycle was pink with metallic flecks that shimmered in the beam of the keychain flashlight Linda used to scan the scene. "Call 911, she said, kneeling down to examine the body. "Already on it," Danny said, his cell phone to his ear as he reached a dispatcher and began explaining what they'd found and where they were. The dead woman was not young. She looked to be in her 60s. One of her slippers had come off in the collision, and it was clearly a collision. Someone hit this woman and kept going. Linda gently rolled the woman on her side for a better look. She aimed the tiny flashlight on the sad, dead face and gasped. "What?" said Kyle, thinking for a moment that life had been detected, that the woman's eyes had flickered or her chest had risen in a breath. "It's Abigail Creek," Linda said. "You know her?" "She stopped by the house last weekend," said Kirsten, "to welcome Linda. I was here. She was a lovely woman."
"Was," Linda said. "She's not lovely now."
The sounds of the night grew around them, crickets moving things. Kyle looked up at the full moon, shining its light through the trees and onto the road. This was no accident. Not in this light. Not with a woman dressed as if she had been running from something.
"Who is Abigail Creek?" Danny asked.
"From Cross Creek Farm," Linda said.
"Well, that explains everything."
Danny already had a knot in his gut and wished they'd had dinner at the house.
"It just might."
Linda gently brushed the woman's matted hair from her face. The four of them stood watch in the dark, waiting for an ambulance that would have no one to save. Chapter 3. Kyle watched the sunrise through Detective Linda's kitchen window as he quietly made breakfast. He was careful not to make a sound. There were three rabbits on the side lawn, nervously looking around as they nibbled at the ground. He wished he'd brought his camera down from the bedroom, but it was too late. The rabbits bounded off when they heard him set a frying pan on the stove. Rabbit ears, he thought. He'd spent many nights in the countryside, most at Pride Lodge, just across the river in Pennsylvania, but he had not realized how rural the area was where Detective Linda lived. The house was on a cleared acre, surrounded by 4 more acres of woods. While the land around here was marked with signs saying no hunting, there was plenty of hunting going on in the area, but the deer were more likely to become roadkill than venison. Kyle was wearing the gray plush robe Danny gave him for his birthday. It was heavier than the October weather required, but he loved the softness of it and the oversized pockets. Beneath it, he had on his traveling pajamas, so named because he only wore them when they visited people. His mother Sally in Chicago, or now at Detective Linda's house. He slept in his boxers at home, but had never been comfortable lounging around in them with anyone but Danny. He patted his belly. Not bad for a man on the cusp of 55. He still had all his hair, and while he was wedded to glasses, he made sure they were fashionable. He and Danny were headed for their 7th year together. Lately, they'd talked of marriage. At this point, it was a matter of when, not if, and they would soon start the long planning phase. Both men knew it would be the only wedding they would ever have. He took a bowl from an overhead cabinet, careful not to make too much noise. He would wait a while longer before starting the eggs, having heard the first stirrings of life from the first floor bedroom. The women were up, and Danny wouldn't be far behind. In the meantime, he took his coffee and sat at the small table, the same table they'd each sat at the night before, giving statements to the New Jersey State Trooper. Her name was Jackie Overly, and she was as no-nonsense as they come. She had glanced several times at Linda and Kirsten, and Kyle wondered if she was sizing them up as family. Even in an age of marriage equality, discretion was still the order of the day. Prejudices could not be legislated away, and if, as Kyle suspected, Trooper Overly was gay, it was something she would not reveal readily, and certainly not while gathering information about a dead woman found on the road. Who was this Abigail Creek? Kyle had tried not to listen from the living room, as each of them spoke separately to Trooper Overly, but the sound carried easily in such a small house. Abigail Creek, he learned, was the matriarch of Cross Creek Farm, a large, long-standing property just a few miles up the road. There was a Cross Creek vineyard, several lines of Cross Creek wines, and a Creek family to go with it all.
He took another sip of his coffee and listened to Danny's footsteps above him in the guest room. Everyone was coming to life at the same time, even as the rabbits, crickets, and birds had long been awake, shouting their presence in the countryside. Linda padded around the bedroom, gathering the clothes she would wear for the day. Some of them were still in boxes. She was slow about making the house her own, as if waiting for permission to fully claim it. Linda had been in the house many times, but never in the bedroom for more than a quick look or following her aunt around as she spoke of one thing or another. Now she was sleeping here. It had been among her hardest tasks to have her own bed brought in from her apartment in New Hope and her aunt's bed removed. Beds are intimate, with mattresses on which we spend a third of our lives, much of that time dreaming. Linda wondered what her aunt dreamed while she slept in this room. She knew what she dreamed for herself, a life with Kirsten, who had just slipped out to the bathroom, a business of her own that would rely entirely on her for success. An unexpected home in the woods, having no idea yet how to care for it. At 44, everything was changing. Everything was new. It was as frightening as it was exciting. "What are you thinking?" Kirsten said, walking back into the bedroom in her chiffon robe. She'd startled Linda, who was standing by the closet, lost in memories. "God, she's beautiful," Linda thought. Kirsten McClellan was a very successful real estate agent, and even in her morning disarray, she looked the part. Thin, short blonde hair, filling out her 47 years with grace and steel. They met at a New Year's Eve party the previous December and knew they were made for each other from the first hello. "What aren't I thinking?" Linda said. "It's all so much, Kirsten. This was my aunt's bedroom, her house. I'm off the police force. I'm about to open a store. I live in the woods, and I don't know how to do any of it." Kirsten walked over and put her arms around Linda. Linda was several inches taller and had always been what her mother called a big-boned gal. Linda's hair had grown out with Kirsten's encouragement, and it flowed in a light brown cascade down her back. "It's like life," Kirsten said, hugging her. "Nobody really knows how to do it until it's done. We learn on the job, sweetie. Start to finish." "I wasn't expecting to have so much more to learn, that's all." "Be careful what you wish for." Linda turned around in Kirsten's arms and kissed her. "But I got what I wished for, and I don't want to be careful. I just don't want to fail." "You're not going to fail. Put that out of your head right this instant. And always remember, there's no failure in trying." The wise real estate agent speaks again. "I read it on a cocktail napkin." "You should be a guru or something. Guru Kirsten. You could write a book on how to live and maybe put out a calendar with wise guru Kirsten sayings for each day of the year. I've been collecting them, you know." "You're silly." Linda gently pushed her away. "Now, let's head out to the kitchen. The boys are up. I'm not sure Kyle ever went to sleep. And I smell bacon." Kirsten stepped away, wrapping the belt around her robe. "What are you going to do today?" she said, already having an idea. "Not sure yet. I find that hard to believe." "What's that supposed to mean?" Linda said, pulling on her jeans. "Kyle and Danny still call you Detective Linda for a reason. It's a term of endearment. Is that what it is? We won't get into trouble, I promise." "Promise all you want," Kirsten said. "Trouble has a way of finding you, especially when you're with Kyle. Now, go ahead out and I'll be along in a minute. I'm not having breakfast in my robe. That's just for you." Linda smiled and slipped out of the bedroom. "It's so quiet here," Danny said, looking up from the kitchen table and out through the window. The foursome had just finished Kyle's breakfast of bacon, eggs, toast, and hash browns. "If you call a million crickets and birds that start chirping before the sun comes up, quiet," Linda said. "You think an alarm clock will wake you up? Try a couple hundred finches or robins or whatever they are."
"You love it," Kirsten said. She dressed in her work clothes, a navy jacket over cream pants and a powder blue blouse. She was heading into New Hope soon to the real estate office that bore her name, McClellan and Powers. Her business partner was Madeline Powers, 10 years her senior and the only person who could still intimidate her.
"It's not that different from New Hope," Kyle said. The trendy Pennsylvania town was only 20 minutes away.
"But it's completely different," Linda said. "It's country here, and I mean country. People think New Jersey's all Newark and Trenton. Most of it's this amazing countryside. And out here, it's not even farmland. It's woods, deer and raccoons and woods.
And I do love it."
"Amazing breakfast, Kyle," Kirsten said, setting her napkin down. "And now I'm off."
"You can't have a showing this early," Linda said. She'd been wondering if Kirsten wasn't so fond of the crickets, birds, and deer, since she often headed back to the big city of New Hope soon after rising.
"We're staging a condo this afternoon. Furniture, decorations, it's all arriving in an hour. The owners are traumatized. They thought their early modern hoarding decor was perfect, but it's been on the market for 2 years, and that's why. We sent them on vacation for a week in Philly, put their massive crap in storage and fumigated. Now, I have to sell the place before they know what hit them."
"She's the best," Linda said. Kyle and Danny hoped it was true, that Kirsten McClellan was the best, not at selling houses and apartments, but at giving Detective Linda the love and support she believed she'd found.
"And where are the three of you off to today?" Kirsten said. She'd stood up from the table and was finishing the few drops of coffee in her cup.
"Nowhere right away," Danny said. "I've got some business calls to make later this morning."
"On a Saturday? Look who's talking. I'm a real estate broker. We work weekends.
And I manage a restaurant."
"Own a restaurant," Kyle corrected him.
"You own a restaurant, along with me and my mother. But I'm the silent partner." Danny and Kyle had pooled their savings and brought in Kyle's mother, Sally, to purchase Margaret's Passion, the Gramercy Park eatery where Danny had worked as the day manager for 10 years. Last spring, it was on the verge of going under, thanks to the scheming of one Linus Hearn, restaurateur from hell, and Danny's sworn enemy. Margaret Bowman, owner and namesake of the restaurant, ended up selling to Danny instead. And now he found himself with a restaurant on his hands. Owning and managing were two very different things, as he'd found out the last few months.
"You're welcome to be on the call with me," Danny said. "We have staffing decisions to make. I want Chloe as the new day manager. Your mother wants to look around."
"I told you, I'm the silent partner. My mother does all the talking. From Chicago, no less."
"She doesn't even need a phone. You can hear her from Manhattan."
Kyle had warned Danny when he suggested bringing in Sally Callahan as the third partner. She had the extra money they needed, and Danny wrongly assumed there would be few strings attached. It all happened very quickly, and Danny had not expected Sally to be quite so hands-on. Even though she lived 700 miles away, she discovered that owning a restaurant in New York City breathed new life into her retirement. She'd be there every day if she could, greeting customers just the way old Margaret Bowman used to. Danny thanked God Chicago was too far to commute.
"Maybe we'll go shopping later," Linda said. "And I want to show the boys the store." She was referring to the storefront in New Hope, where she would soon start her business. It was empty now and being renovated with a grand opening set for late November.
"But first, Linda stared at her. Damn, the woman was too good at reading her mind. Would she ever be able to do the same?
But first, Linda said, I thought Kyle and I could head up the road a ways.
To extend your condolences?
It's the right thing to do. Let me guess, Kyle said. He'd suspected this was coming, that it was inevitable, and he might as well surrender.
We'll be visiting Cross Creek Farm?
Abigail was kind enough to stop and introduce herself. It's only right that I pay a house call.
You don't know anything about the creeks, said Kirsten, and you may not want to find out.
She didn't deserve to die alone like that. All I want to do is offer my sympathies. They won't even know we're the ones who found the body.
And you won't tell them.
10 minutes later, Kirsten McClellan was easing her new BMW out of the drive, careful not to let the overhanging tree limbs brush too heavily against its dark blue finish. Linda watched her from the kitchen door while Danny and Kyle cleared the table.
I'll get the dishes, Linda said. Just leave them on the counter. You cooked, I'll clean.
Fair enough, Kyle said.
I want to shower and dress before we head out to extend your condolences.
It might just be a terrible accident.
Or it might be murder, Danny said as he headed into the living room to watch the morning news.
As long as he got some time away from the city, he could leave Kyle and Detective Linda to their own devices.
We'll be back in an hour, Linda said, as she rinsed off their dishes in the left sink bin.
I'll drive. Kyle took a deep breath. He knew once they started down this road, they would not turn back until they reached its end. He hoped they would not regret it as much as Abigail Creek had. Country roads could enchant you with their tree canopies and their hidden streams. And sometimes, they got you killed.
Enjoy 3-chapter samples of all my audiobooks. Just go to markmcneese.com/listenlounge. You can listen to the entire audiobooks by finding them at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, various other audiobook retailers, or directly from my website,